At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Detroit, Michigan, known for the auto industry, Motown Records, the Red Wings, and the 68 Tigers. And as of today, the biggest municipal bankruptcy ever. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is the Marketplace podcast for Thursday, the 18th of July. Good to have you with us. $18.5 billion in debt and 16 pages. Those are the operative numbers in Detroit's bankruptcy filing late this afternoon. The city's emergency manager, Kevin Orr, submitted a 16-page petition to the bankruptcy court in Detroit today after failing to come to terms with the city's creditors. Daniel Howes is the business columnist at the Detroit News. Mr. Howes, it's good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
Detroit's financial problems are well known. What happened? Why now this filing?
Well, the governor had appointed an emergency manager back in March, and it was very abundantly clear to us that this person's skill set were going to lead us to a Chapter 9 bankruptcy filing, and I wrote as much probably a month or so after he got here. But Detroit's problems have been building for some time. It's lost a quarter of its population in the last decade. It hasn't had a budget surplus since 2004. It's insolvent. It can't pay its debts, and the situation is getting worse. Citizens wait 58 minutes for a cop to come to a call. It is a really bad situation.
So what's the actual procedure of events here? The paperwork has been filed. Does that immediately put them into Chapter 9?
Yes, they're in Chapter 9. They get an automatic stay against any litigation, which is starting to really build now. Lawyers for unions and for retirees have been trying to get the state courts to block the governor from taking this action. And we'd expected it maybe as early as tomorrow or Monday at the latest. But there's a big hearing up in Ingham County, which is where the state capital is, on Monday. And I think there was a fear that the judge could issue some kind of temporary restraining order that might try to block the governor from taking this action. So he's taking it today.
You listed a bunch of things that have happened in Detroit, loss of population, infrastructure problems, all of those things. Given that, is there a way out of bankruptcy? I mean, eventually stories will say Detroit emerged from bankruptcy today. What's that going to look like?
Well, I don't know what it's going to look like. And I would say to you that I think the people that are doing this, much less the people like me that are covering it, don't know how this story is going to end. You know, the governor and his people seem to think that they can execute this bankruptcy in about 12 months, which would make it in time for the general election campaign next fall for his reelection. you talk to bankruptcy experts, and they pretty much laugh in your face when you say that. A lot of people think it could be a 3 to 5 year process. This is going to set a lot of precedent around the country. The emergency manager, Kevin Orr, has declared general obligation bonds to be unsecured debt, which has shocked the municipal markets. And he's also trying to give the unions and the pension funds quite a substantial haircut. So I think both public sector unions and the municipal markets are going to be looking at this, because it's going to be setting a lot of precedent to see how a judge rules on what is the largest Chapter 9 bankruptcy in American history.
Go into those municipal markets for me for a second. What are the odds that anybody lends Detroit money to help them get through this bankruptcy?
Not good. And they've, in fact, the creditors have been bringing that point up. And then Kevin Orr, the emergency manager, has responded by saying, well, our plan is that Detroit wouldn't go to the public markets for 10 years and that we'll be self-financing. And I think the markets kind of, the response to that is, are you serious? The second thing they say is that it's going to have a very deleterious effect on other municipalities in Michigan and their abilities to borrow. Even next door to Detroit, Oakland County is a AAA rated community, one of the best financially managed communities in the United States. And I think the fear is that their bond ratings are going to get whacked. And their people have, in fact, been quoted in the last 2 or 3 days saying that.
More to come on this story. Daniel House at the Detroit News. Mr. House, thanks a lot for your time, sir.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Kevin Orr conveniently waited till after the bell today to file, so the municipal bond market is going to have to wait until tomorrow. As for equities, more ups than downs. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There's a certain familiarity to the financial regulatory alphabet that we all use. SEC, you know, Securities and Exchange Commission. CFTC, probably too, the Commodities Futures Trading Commission. How about FERC? That ring a bell? The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission hit Barclays this week with a nearly $500 million fine. It's looking at a $500 million settlement with J.P. Morgan as well. Both, the agency says, for manipulating energy markets. So wait, is that an Enron flashback thing I'm feeling? Yes and no. Stan Alcorn has the story from New York.
The scheming that led to Enron's collapse more than a decade ago did include manipulating energy prices. But attorney Mark Spitzer says the manipulation we're hearing about today is different.
Enron was shutting down plants to drive spikes in prices. Can't do that anymore. It's not been done.
Enron's manipulation caused rolling blackouts in California, and traders were caught on tape laughing about their profits.
All the money you guys stole from those poor grandmothers of California?
Yeah, Grandma Millie, man.
Yeah, now she wants money back.
Back then, the Energy Commission that was supposed to regulate Enron couldn't even make it pay a fine. Former Commissioner Nora Mead Brownell says the hundreds of millions they're seeking from J.P. Morgan and Barclays show how much has changed.
There's much more structure, much more oversight, fining authority, and in ever-increasing dedicated staff.
But the energy market has changed too, according to University of Texas law professor David Spence.
Banks have slowly gotten into that same space that Enron used to occupy.
In other words, banks are now energy traders. Their purely financial interest could mean more of the market manipulation that Barclays and J.P. Morgan have been accused of.
Certainly there's an incentive if that's the case.
But so far, Barclays has denied any wrongdoing, and J.P. Morgan hasn't commented. In New York, I'm Stan Alcorn for Marketplace.
Couple of things before we move on. First of all, we goofed yesterday in our genealogy story. It's properly the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Also, but not at all related, pay attention to the music we're using on the program today. We'll explain that one for you a little bit later on. In London, England, there's a move afoot to make the UK the world's leading center for Islamic finance. The government over there wants to make Britain the global hub for transactions that conform to Muslim principles. Islamic finance is growing, so there's money on the line. But some Brits are wary of this particular revenue stream, as Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
Zahi Chisti is a meticulous man. He has to be. As a pharmacist, he must carefully measure the medicine he dispenses. And when it comes to money, Zahid also likes to do things by the book. In this case, the Quran.
Under Sharia law, we're prohibited from taking or giving interest. I try to avoid giving or taking interest with any of the transactions that I process.
When he saves money with his local Islamic bank, he doesn't earn interest. He shares in the profit the bank makes from investing his funds. And the bank doesn't invest in anything un-Islamic, like alcohol or gambling. Zahid takes this as seriously as he takes his Muslim faith, and that's very seriously indeed.
It's paramount. It's the first thing that I think of when I wake, and it's the last thing I think of when I go to sleep. It's what makes me.
There are 3 million Muslims living in Britain. Not all are devout, but more and more of them are demanding financial products compatible with their faith. Sultan Chowdhury runs the UK's first fully Sharia-compliant bank, the Islamic Bank of Britain. He says his business is booming.
Our mortgage book, Islamic mortgage book, has gone up nearly 90% in 1 year. Our deposits have gone up 22%. Customer numbers are growing on average 8% per annum.
This is a global phenomenon. Worldwide, Islamic finance is now a $1 trillion-a-year industry, and it's growing fast.
It's at about $1.2 trillion now. It's due to grow to about $4.4 trillion by 2020.
David Slater of London & Partners, a body set up to promote business in the British capital.
You know, we look at a growing market and think to ourselves, we would like to have more of that.
Slater and his colleagues, backed by the British government, are now pushing for London to become the global hub for Islamic finance. And they'll be pressing their case at a huge gathering of Muslim politicians, business leaders and scholars from the Middle East and beyond to be held in London in the fall.
We want to say we're open for business and we want your business and we will produce the right sort of products to enable that business.
Britain's already open for Islamic business. More Islamic bonds are traded here on the London Stock Exchange than anywhere else. The UK has already changed its commercial and taxation laws to accommodate Sharia-compliant finance. But not everyone thanks heaven for that.
There's a secularist. I don't think religion should be playing a part in our finance system in this way.
Terry Sanderson, president of the National Secular Society, he's worried that by expanding Islamic finance, Britain may be letting Sharia law in by the back door and giving British and foreign Muslims too much political leverage.
They would have a large stake in this country through the finance system, which they might use to manipulate the political processes. I'm not saying they will do that, but that's a possibility if it becomes really big.
But London is the ultimate international financial souk. More currencies are traded here than anywhere on earth. There's every conceivable form of finance. Advocates for this financial centre say it's too big to bully and has nothing to fear from Sharia. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Coming up, why music journalism online beats the printed page.
For us, you know, it's like we get to have a different cover every single day. So we're able to give the same kind of treatment to, you know, the White Stripes and Radiohead as we do to brand new emerging artists who are maybe on their debut EP or LP.
But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial is up 78 points today, about 0.5%, closed at 15,548. The blue chips did. The NASDAQ rose a single point. We'll call that flat, 3611. The number of the S&P 500 gained 8 points, 0.5%, ended at 1689. Another big bank, Morgan Stanley, reported a surge in earnings today. It also got a green light from the Fed to buy back some of its stock, sign, one believes, of financial health. Morgan Stanley shares up 4% today. IBM rose 1.75% after predicting higher earnings, but Intel fell 3.75% after saying sales may miss estimates as the personal computer business continues to shrink. eBay did miss predictions and got marked down nearly 7% today. Boeing gained 2.7% after UK regulators blamed last week's 787 fire on an emergency beacon made by Honeywell. Honeywell shares actually rose today, 0.6%, after they said that part is easily replaced. You're listening to Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. On July 19, 1903, Maurice Garon won the inaugural Tour de France. GE is slated to report quarterly earnings, and Comic-Con continues in San Diego. Tomorrow's extensive list of programs includes The Business of Fan Art, Star Wars Origami, and Superheroes, The Never-Ending Battle. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Ruzdahl. The culture of Silicon Valley, or maybe the mental image that the rest of us have of the culture of Silicon Valley, gets talked about a lot. Rich college dropouts hitting it big, running around the Bay Area in T-shirts and sneakers, enjoying their free office food and all those perks. But there is another side of the whole tech geek culture, the trade-off that sometimes comes with being really good at data, but not being so good with the human stuff. Gabriel Roth's debut novel, The Unknowns, deals with just that kind of thing. Welcome to the program.
Good to be here.
This is some combination of coming of age and big data and the tech boom and what, romance, I guess, all in one. It's quite a story.
That's right. The protagonist of my novel, The Unknowns, his name is Eric Muller, and we meet him as a teenager. He's really good with computers.
He's just a geek, man. I mean, honestly, come on, right?
Well, I think that's right.
Okay, all right.
Really good with computers, not that great with social interactions, particularly not that great with girls. And he's going around using his very rational, very data-oriented brain to try to gather information and understand and think through every single social interaction as though it can be understood and controlled in the way that you could understand computer code. Yeah. And that just doesn't work when it comes to human interaction.
Picking up on that idea, though, of how Eric goes about codifying his life and using this big data, you know, he says at one point that his partner in this firm he eventually starts tried to convince Eric that lubricating the flow of information about individual consumer preferences would constitute a meaningful contribution to human happiness. I mean, that's sort of what goes on with big data today. That's what Amazon is trying to convince us of. That's what, I mean, all these big companies who have our data are trying to convince us that it's good for human life and existence.
Well, there's a sort of neo-libertarian ideology behind a lot of these new technological startups that often assumes if they can make a lot of money collecting information, moving it around and selling it back to other people, then it must, by definition, be good for us.
Yeah.
And, of course, I'm not convinced that that's true.
Yeah. What is it about and, you know, this obviously comes with the news of Edward Snowden and the NSA and all that. What is it that scares us about large entities knowing so much about us, even if it's anonymous data?
Well, fundamentally, I think there's a feeling of powerlessness, right? And when it comes to a big government agency like the NSA, we are essentially powerless and it can do what it wants with us. When it comes to a big commercial enterprise like Facebook or Google, I don't know that that's quite as true, but we still have that same sense that I'm just a tiny little speck compared to Google. And what's Google want with me? What are they going to do with me?
So what were you trying to do? Were you trying to humanize this use of big data, or were you trying to make us see the peril that lies within?
Well, it started from the human experience and from that sense that you sometimes have in interactions of wondering what other people are thinking about you and what they know about you. And it was only after I started working on and writing about that sort of interaction that I realized, oh, there's a connection here to these other questions that are coming up in discussions of business and politics and so on.
Yeah. This process of having a first book and shepherding it through the writing, which I gather took years, and then the revising, and then finally the sale of it, is it something that recommends itself to you? Did you enjoy it as a process?
I enjoyed the writing very much, not in the sense that, oh, this is really fun, but yeah, in the sense that this is challenging and interesting and you're up against some interesting limitation of your own every day.
Yeah.
Then the subsequent part of trying to get it published and trying to get it sold, that I don't really recommend to anyone. That was miserable.
Gabriel Roth, his first book is called The Unknowns. Thanks a lot.
Thank you for having me.
It's usually the really big ticket items in the Pentagon budget that get all the press. The new F-35 Joint Strike Fighter, for just one example, costing as much as $200 million a copy. But sometimes it's the little things that count, like the clothes on a soldier's back. Some good old-fashioned inter-service rivalries have driven up the cost of camouflage uniforms, as Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports.
You ever been to a party and found that someone else is wearing the same exact outfit you've got on? Well, then you know how the top brass at the Pentagon feels. See, in the late 80s and throughout the 90s, there were just two camouflage uniforms for all U.S. troops, green for when you were in the forest and brown for the desert. How boring. The Marines were the first to break the mold.
The few, the proud.
How could the few and proud wear the outfit of the many? Unthinkable. So in 2002, the Marines developed their own camouflage pattern. It was computer-generated. Small pixels instead of big, clumsy blotches. Really cool. The new camo was a big hit at the Marine Corps base in Quantico, Virginia. Today, Marines like Corporal Mark Gray can't imagine wearing anything else.
I graduated from boot camp wearing that uniform, something I worked so entirely hard for. I mean, I can't see myself wearing a Navy uniform or Army uniform or anything like that. It's just part of who I am now.
The new Marine combat uniforms made everybody else look dated, like they were stuck in the 90s. So the Army, Navy, and Air Force started an arms race to avoid uniformity in uniforms at all costs. The Government Accountability Office says more than $12 million was spent just designing the new combat camo. There are now at least 10 different uniforms. The original justification for the multiple uniforms was they improved morale, created esprit de corps. When Congressman Bill Enyart hears that, he thinks
that the esprit de corps argument is quite frankly silly. It's a couple of kids in a sandbox arguing over whose truck is better.
Enyart wants the kids to play nicely and share. So the Illinois Democrat and veteran introduced legislation that mandates one camouflage pattern for everyone in two colors, going back to green for the woods and brown for the desert. And the various military branches couldn't come up with a new camo design unless they were willing to share it with everybody else. Enyart's amendment is part of the defense spending bill passed by the House. The Senate is considering something similar.
It's pure madness.
Of course, not everybody's happy. Winslow Wheeler is a defense analyst at the Project on Government Oversight. He says Congress is micromanaging the Pentagon and should focus on big reforms that would save real money.
This is not going to save any money to speak of. Congress is studiously avoiding all of the important budgetary and effectiveness issues in this budget, just as they have for a long time.
Issues like closing unneeded bases and overhauling the military's very expensive health care system. Congressman Enyart says you have to start somewhere. His amendment could save as much as $250 million. Yes, just a blip in the budget, but maybe a first step in taming inter-service rivalry that ends up costing taxpayers billions. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
The music industry has seen a lot of change the past couple of years, as has the industry covering that industry. The Spin magazines and Rolling Stones and Vibes of the world. Print editions have been cut. Relevance has been questioned. But there is one music journalism outfit that seems to have it all figured out. Pitchfork is credited with launching indie rock bands like Arcade Fire and Vampire Weekend and staying successful all the while, more than a million online visitors a month. They've also got a big festival going on in Chicago this weekend, the Pitchfork Music Festival. So today on Conversations from the Corner Office, Ryan Schreiber, the CEO and founder of Pitchfork. Ryan, it's good to have you with us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
You seem to have discovered somehow how to make a business of the business of writing about music. It's kind of interesting because the magazines, the print magazines, are having a tougher time.
And it actually took some time. I mean, for the first 4 years, it wasn't even really what you might consider a business. It was just me for that period, and anybody else who wanted to write for it, you know, they might get some free CDs out of it or something like that. But I mean, as it's sort of grown, it's like you kind of adapt and figure out your way along. And I think that for a lot of the larger publications, print and even online to an extent, it's very much traffic-based approach to music. I mean, who they would put on the covers, for example, would be tied to who's going to sell the most issues. And for us, you know, it's like we get to have a different cover every single day because we have five record reviews a day. So we're able to give the same kind of treatment to, you know, the White Stripes and Radiohead as we do to brand new emerging artists who are maybe on their debut EP or LP.
EP and LP, that's so old school, man. Are you kidding me?
Well, you know.
The thing about it, though, is you started with independent music and alternative music, and now this festival you guys have in Chicago this weekend, you've got Bjork and R. Kelly. I mean, you've got some ginormous names.
I mean, we kind of went into this year's festival with a little bit of a different approach, a different mindset. I mean, when we first started doing the festival, we were one of the only independent music festivals kind of a mid-range scale that existed. Now it seems like there's one in almost every town. So this year we wanted to kind of approach our headliners from a perspective of artists who are not kind of on an album cycle, because I saw a pattern where artists who are kind of out promoting something right now will kind of make rounds and structure their tour around festivals. So we wanted to do something that was getting artists who are not promoting anything and maybe would be a little bit more unique for us. And it's also, I wanted to get artists too that a lot of people hadn't seen several times. So there was a little bit of a balance there.
How do you, though, thread the needle, if you will, between what is clearly promotional, right? These festivals are promotional. They're events for the performers and for the fans. And then your editorial product, which I imagine you need to be unbiased reviews of the viability of this music.
You know, to us, it's really never been a problem. There's not even really an advantage. I mean, reviews, scores, ratings, these things wouldn't work as currency. Do you know what I mean? But, you know, we've had artists who receive 10.0s not play the festival or turn down or decline it. And we've had artists who'd receive 0.0s come and play the festival.
We're, what, halfway through the year? You got a favorite album? You got a favorite song yet?
I think... Oh, man. Could I pick out my favorite song right now?
Yeah, all right.
Well, let me tell you. Probably my favorite, one of my favorite songs this year is actually a song that came out. It's not even officially released. It's this guy, Jay Paul, who's in the UK, and he has a song called Straight Out of Mumbai that is just sort of a cluster of insane sort of sound effects. The guy is sort of a studio whiz, but he's also very, like, reclusive, hasn't really done interviews. Nobody really knows that much about him. He's sort of an enigma, and that's probably one of the most creative, most interesting things I've heard this year.
All right, we'll look it up. Ryan Schreiber, he's the founder and CEO of Pitchfork. Ryan, thanks a bunch.
Thanks a lot.
All the music you've been hearing on the show today, all chosen by Ryan Schreiber, special for us. We've got the whole playlist at marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, we started, as you know, with the news that Detroit has filed for bankruptcy, the biggest municipal default this country has ever seen. So on the way out, some context on that city of 700,000 people, which, by the way, is less than half of what Detroit's population was back in 1950. The unemployment rate in Detroit is now above 18%. Less than half of the city's residents over the age of 16 are working. Per capita income is just over $15,000 per year. And the Motor City is now home to one auto plant, one, a Chrysler place that makes the Jeep Grand Cherokee. And with that, we're out of here. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow added 78 points, about 0.5%. The NASDAQ gained 1 point. The S&P 500 bumped up 8 points. That's 0.5%. John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, George Judson, Jonathan Karp, Ethan Lindsay, Sylvester Monroe, Betsy Streisand, and Celeste Wesson are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Sarah Gilbert. I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us back here tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.